We're up to Daniel 5. And Daniel 5, of course, the fifth chapter of Daniel is one that is dramatic. No question about that when you realize that the handwriting on the wall that occurs in this chapter is full of drama. But to bring us back up to date, Daniel, the name Daniel, means God judges, or God is my judge. That can be taken personally, or it can be thought of in general, that God judges individuals or judges the entirety of the human landscape. What we will learn as we proceed through this particular passage are several things. First of all, Daniel is not written in chronological order. We are used to having things proceed along in an orderly fashion. In fact, sometimes we have trouble reading modern novels that use flashback form in presenting a story. We kind of like it to go straight step by step. Even when we see movies that use that method, we kind of lose our place, what happened and how did that happen and so forth. And sometimes I think the book of Daniel is assumed to be chronological. Well, the first six chapters, you could say, are in a chronological order, but the last part of the book are dreams that Daniel had during the course of his exposure to a wide range of kings, from the Babylonian kings to the kings of Medo-Persian Empire. So we'll get to that in a moment, but I want to remind you that Daniel is not chronologically written. We also have to understand that the essential notion of the book is that Daniel, as well as the Hebrew boys, exhibited a very strong faith. You can't get faith stronger than telling Nebuchadnezzar that if God chooses to spare us from a fiery furnace or not, we will not bow down and worship your image. That's faith. That's serious faith. Now, I got to thinking about that, and I said, well, I can make it personal, or I could talk about you, and I think I choose the latter. How many of you could face that kind of challenge and then exhibit the courage displayed by those three boys? Don't raise your hands. But that is the question. Later on in the sixth chapter, we will find Daniel thrown into a den of lions. How many of us could face such a dilemma and come out on the winning side? But as the Hebrew boy says, even if God chooses not to spare our lives, we will have our faith in him. Now, we talk a lot about faith. It's talked about in great glowing terms. And believe it or not, people not of this fellowship have lived by faith. Do not ever assume that because we have knowledge about the Sabbath and the holy days that we're the bastion of faith keepers. Don't ever believe that. Because people have had conditions in their lives, for instance, in the tragedy in Colorado, and this dates this tape to some degree by mentioning it, but in Littleton, Colorado, did you notice that in many of the interviews there was a lot of talk about God and prayer? You never noticed that? But what was striking yesterday morning was to see the parents of the girl who was shot at point-blank range, and she survived, or is surviving, with no internal damage to her organs at point-blank range, with powder burns from the gun being so close to her. And they talk about a miracle, and they talk about the faith that they possessed and how they lived by it. Now, we can minimize that, and we can think of all kinds of cute little deals, but when we really boil down our existence in this veil of tears, we must come to recognize that God requires of us, according to the book of Hebrews, that those who come to him must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them who diligently seek him. In other words, those who are full of faith. That is the essential notion. And many times in the course of our lives, we are challenged to exhibit it, and many times we fall short. So as we go through this series on Here Comes the Judge, let that be the abiding notion, that we must exhibit strong faith and astonishing courage, because that is what the central character of the book shows us. And he shows it in a way, and this is the third point to be considered in going through this series, that Daniel never gives a thus saith the Lord. He is not a prophet like Ezekiel was, or a prophet like Jeremiah was, or Isaiah for that matter, who came to a people and says, thus says the Lord. You cannot find any quotation in the book of Daniel like that. What you find is a man living his life. And because he was of royal blood from the kingdom of Judah, and then taken around 606 B.C., just as the time of Nebuchadnezzar's reign beginning around 605, and carried away as one of the captives, and by the way, that was years before Jerusalem ultimately fell. But he's taken along with others of the royals to have them acclimatized to the way of the Babylonians, to have them schooled, have them trained in the ways of the kingdom of Babylon. And yet he lived his life in the midst of that pressure in such a way that we can learn lessons. Because in his presentations, what Daniel had was a gift. You might call him a psychic warrior. You know about psychic hotlines and so forth. People who interpret stuff in your life, and if you tell them a little this, and they'll tell you what your dreams mean and that kind of thing. Well, Daniel had a hotline too. And Daniel was able, by his gift, to interpret dreams. Not just, I should say it this way, any kind of dream. Didn't matter what kind of dream. It wasn't just the king's dream, because there were individuals who had had their dreams interpreted who brought that to the attention of Nebuchadnezzar. When he had a dream, Daniel had that ability to mix in the mix of the society around him and never lose what he was supposed to do. Just bringing then us up to date about this Daniel as we proceed through this fifth installment. Now, before we get into the chapter, there are a couple of other things to note. Belshazzar was not the son of Nebuchadnezzar. But when we read the Bible sometimes, it will refer to a child who in fact may be a grandchild as son. Because really what is being displayed is that this is a descendant of. Nebuchadnezzar's reign was approximately 50 years, from 605 B.C. to about 555, somewhere along in there. And then a new king, Nabonidus, became king, but Belshazzar was his co-regent, that is, co-ruler, because Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus, thus the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. If you turn to Jeremiah 27 and see how the Bible confirms this, Jeremiah 27 and verse 7, beginning in verse 6, and now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant, and I have given him also the wild animals of the field to serve him. Did you catch that? Who Nebuchadnezzar was? The king of Babylon, the high mucky muck of the entire globe as it was known at that time. He was God's servant. And all the nations shall serve him, and his son, and his grandson, until the time of his own land comes, then many nations and great kings will make him their servant. We know that it was in the reign of Belshazzar that Babylon fell. Thus, it had to be the grandson at the time of that fall, as we will see in the chapter that we are pursuing now. One of the objections to the book of Daniel is its historic authenticity. There are people who are concerned about that. They're concerned about two things, about the 11th chapter in particular that is so detailed about these realms that were going to be successive in ruling the world. But that's the reason they're concerned about that is that it seems to question the revelatory ability of God, that God could give revelation so far in advance. So they got to minimize that. But the other issue is the historicity of the book, the authenticity of some of the things that are mentioned here, especially in this fifth chapter. But nothing in the Greek histories of people like Herodotus, these are highfalutin names when you're dealing with PhDs, you got to mention folk like this. So if they're listening on tapes that will come out, they'll know we did our homework, okay? Herodotus, Xenophon. That sounds interesting. Xenophon. You get the word xenophobia kind of locked in there someplace. And Berossus. Well, these are Greeks who wrote histories on this side of the turn of, well, I couldn't say the turn of the century, but after Christ, A.D., so to speak. But they wrote about some of these individuals, these situations, and they do not dispute the account of the book of Daniel. In fact, you can go to some of the chronicles, the Nabonidus chronicle that was a compilation of the king or the reign of Nabonidus, who was the father of Belshazzar, and also look into Cyrus, his cylinder. Cyrus was the Persian. Cyrus the Persian, you know, the Medes and the Persians. Cyrus was the kind of the co-regent with Darius the Mede. So all of these names show up in the book of Daniel at some point in time, but they confirm some of the things that we find here in this book. Now, I read in Jeremiah just briefly that Nebuchadnezzar was God's servant. And what we learn from the book of Daniel also is that God used Babylon to chastise Judah, then dealt with the Babylonians because of a serious flaw, and dealt with them in a very dramatic fashion, as displayed in this fifth chapter. So let's go to the fifth chapter of Daniel now and take a look and see what we find here. Belshazzar, in verse 1, the king, by the way, Belshazzar, what does that mean? Because remember, Daniel's Babylonian name was Belteshazzar. Bel was the chief pagan god, along with Nabu and a whole series of others, but Bel was one, and so the god's name would appear in the names of the kings, or the names of the rulers. Belshazzar simply means protect, or Bel, protect the king. So he was named, you know, appropriately to have God protect him, or their God protect them. Belteshazzar, on the other hand, had a different meaning. It's God protect his life, not protect the king, but protect his life. In the case of Daniel, he was named what they wanted to have happen for him, that Bel would protect Daniel. But Daniel's real name, of course, is God Judges. So Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of the nobles. And by the way, between chapters 4 and chapter 5, a number of years transpire. Quite a few years, in fact. The reign of Nabonidus was approximately 556, which would have been the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, all the way to 539 B.C. We do know that the fall of Jerusalem was around 586, so you can do the math and see where it all fits together. But Nabonidus kind of went into semi-retirement. His son was the co-regent, and thus Nabonidus moved down to Arabia in a place called Teman. And he was in luxury and retirement and so forth, and then Belshazzar is the chief mucky-muck. Now, he is the co-regent, but technically he was never the king. He was never the full king. He was never reigning by himself. Belshazzar then held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the thousands. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, in the order that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Now, that was a serious mistake. Because whatever we might think of Jerusalem, or whatever we might think of the Judeans, or the house of Judah and their falling away from God, the implements and the vessels that were taken out of the temple were still holy to God. It did not matter where they were placed. It did not matter where they were removed to. They had been dedicated to the perfect use of those who served in the temple. And because they were hallowed or set apart, it was a mistake for Belshazzar to treat them so commonly. I believe that ties in with a vision that Peter had in the book of Acts, when he saw this tremendous sheet with all of the display of the various animals on it, and he said to God, "My lips have never tasted anything unclean or common." And God says, "Don't call anything that I have sanctified common or unclean. You can't use it in any kind of way. You can't be dismissive of it any kind of way or be flippant about it." Belshazzar had to learn that lesson, and I suppose it is a lesson for us today in how we handle that which is sacred to God. Be it a tithe, be it a person, be it a calling, we have to be careful how we handle it, for God will judge. Verse 3 says, "They brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the kings and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them." They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. You can imagine the picture. In fact, they've made some movies that include this audacious event. Suddenly, in verse 5, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the pilaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hips joint went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Whose hand was that? Whose hand do we see? Could it be the hand of God? Well, at one time, we know that the finger of God or the hand of God wrote on tablets of stone in a mountain called Sinai. Is it possible that he would deign to come down to confront this lofty king by revealing just his hand? Or did he send a messenger to do it? Many times in passages like this, we get hung up in major and the minors because we get to figuring, well, now, whose hand was that? And miss the message. And miss the message. Now, the hand was enough to shake Belshazzar, to be sure. But I think the message was the one that was concerning him, because he didn't understand what it said. He was troubled by it. And have you ever had your knees knocked together? Have you grown weak in the knees about something? Perhaps you went to the doctor and they told you something that took all the strength out of you, or you several checks bounced and you got weak in the knees, or you got a special delivery from the IRS. Something that would make you weak in the knees. You could get some sense of what Belshazzar felt at this moment. The king called to bring the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. All of these people, perhaps if he had had a psychic hotline, he could have called Dionne Warwick up and asked some advice, or someone like that, because they make a lot of money off of them. But these are soothsayers. These are people who are around, who have their PhDs, you know, piled higher and deeper. They have this philosophical insight. You see them on television daily. They are called the experts. Now, what should we think about what happened in Littleton, Colorado? What kind of preventatives could we use? And so they have Dr. So-and-so and Professor So-and-so, all of these people come as experts to tell us these things. And so Nebuchadnezzar, he had them back in Daniel's day when we were introduced to Daniel. He had them. He called for them to interpret his dream. In fact, he put a real twist on them. He says, "I'm not going to tell you the dream," Nebuchadnezzar said. "You got to tell me the dream and then what it means." And he knew that they couldn't do that because many of these people go with some set ideas. So Belshazzar was no different. He had in his realm these same individuals. So the king spoke to the wise men of Babylon in verse 7. Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. That's important to note. Why third ruler? Well, because he and his father were co-regents, you see. And therefore, Daniel could not be second in the kingdom because Nabonidus was over in Arabia, kind of in semi-retirement, and the co-regent, his son, Belshazzar, is ruling, so he could only become the third ruler in the kingdom. Verse 8, then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, his face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. I imagine if we could be a fly on the wall at NATO headquarters, or in the White House, or in the boardrooms of some of the major corporations of the world, there are times when there is perplexity and concern and bafflement. Well, I need not fly that far away. Just up there on the hill, from time to time, there is perplexity as we consider certain realities facing the Church of God International. And sometimes you get weak in the knees. It's a reality. But maybe it's just at your kitchen table when you're trying to figure out how to stretch money over the bills. It's a reality. But how do you manage it? How then do you make it through in those times of complexities and perplexities? Well, somebody remembered the old days. Verse 10, the queen entered the banquet hall, and some speculate that this queen, in fact, was the queen mother, not the one married to Belshazzar, but in fact was his mother, not the queen in the sense of his bride. She comes in and enters the banquet hall because of the word of the king and his nobles. Well, why wasn't she partying hardy with these vessels from Jerusalem and the temple? But she comes in to this party. The queen spoke up and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, your grandfather, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. There was a reticence to let go of the concept of the panoply of gods. It still had not diminished. And so they thought of, some people thought of the God of Daniel just like other gods. And I think Mr. Stinson has explained that in a way. And if you had not heard the program when we went through the commandments about the issue of thou shalt not have any other God above me, it's explained in a beautiful way. In other words, there are all these other gods, and of course he ridicules them. God ridicules them. They can't see. They got to be led by the hand. They can't do anything. But you better not have any of those in place of me. He didn't deny that people bowed down to them or they existed in the minds of other folk. He just says they can't compare to me. Besides me, there is no other. But the people of Babylon still had not matriculated to that point of view yet, though Nebuchadnezzar had. And we will find in this book, of this chapter, that Belshazzar should have known better, as Daniel will remind him. But we go on and see, continuing in verse 11, and King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. I ask the question at this point, was Daniel in retirement? Was he kind of off, you know, in his own home someplace and doing the things that go through life, living life in a regular fashion, and yet somebody remembered? If in the time of trouble, nobody ever calls on you because they don't think of you as being godly, is that a problem? They would never call on you. They would never remember, you know, I remember this person. we used to eat lunch together, and we used to talk about the Bible and talk about God, and I think I'll call them to get some advice. Have you ever had that happen? Some of you have. If you haven't, you still have a ways to go. All of us are walking down a road to a destination, and thus, it's something to consider. Here is Daniel, regular guy, you might say, who refused all of the dainties of Nebuchadnezzar and so forth, off away out of sight. And they remembered. Then the men came, in verse 11, these men came by arrangement or agreement and found Daniel petition and supplication before his God. Can you believe that? What did they find Daniel doing? Praying. Well, he was known for doing that. And I bet you there were people who said, "Boy, that guy prays a lot. Doesn't he do anything else? Doesn't he go to the bars or hangs out? And doesn't he exercise like the rest of us? Isn't he watching the stock market? I mean, isn't he paying attention to his supplies and so forth? But he's praying all the time. That's super religious, isn't it?" Well, would be to God that we were like Daniel. Daniel got his prayers answered. Daniel made it through on faith. I don't know how to explain it other than that, but there is an example. They find him praying, verse 12. They approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not... Oh, I turned too many pages, excuse me. It was over in the sixth chapter already. Okay, here we go. I flip over to verse 12 now. I read you verse 11. Actually, that was 11:6. The sixth chapter in verse 11 about them coming to Daniel. I was ahead of the story. We'll come back to that when he gets ready to be thrown in the lion's den. But now, continuing on here, this was because of an extraordinary spirit that he had, Daniel. Knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Bel preserve him. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. Well, verse 13 through 17, or 16, have Daniel coming and being questioned by Belshazzar. Verse 13 says, "Are you that Daniel, who is the one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah?" Well, he was. Certainly he knew. But sometimes we forget. "Now I've heard about you and the spirit of the gods in you." Now, some people can assume that you have a special gift, that you are special. But the fact is that Daniel knew who to credit for his speciality. He knew it was not contained within himself. So, being quizzed by this, verse 17, we come to the answer. Because verses 13 through 16 is a repetition of what has already been said about the abilities of Daniel. And the promise, of course, was made in verse 16, that you'll get all of these things and be third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel responds in verse 17 is thus: "Keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him." I rack my brain to imagine a situation. And the closest thing I could come up with in my own experience, perhaps you've had others, is once I was called for a witness in a trial. It was a situation right here in Tyler where an individual had been roughed up by the police, and he had a record. He was on parole. And because he was on parole, one particular judge in this community feels that if you break parole in any kind of way, you got to go back to jail, no matter what the circumstance. In this case, the man owned a restaurant, a business, in which he was dutifully going about not only making the restaurant work, but also worked another job besides. So he was doing everything was possible to do, but because he had a record, the police stopped him in front of his place of business because he was parked on the wrong side of the street. And by running his license plate, realized he had a record, and so there was a confrontation. And I had a chance to testify on his behalf. As you sit there in the witness box and you're asked certain things by the prosecutor, it's like being quizzed here by Daniel being quizzed as to what do you think about this and what do you think about that and so forth and so on. And you have to answer it truthfully and forthrightly. That's the closest I could come, but perhaps you can think of another type of situation that you might face similar to that. Well, here is Daniel being put on the spot, and his response is interesting. Verse 18, O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father or your grandfather. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whoever he wished to be killed, and whomever he wished to be spared alive, and whomever he wished to elevate, and whomever he wished to humble. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. Just rehearsing for you, Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 43 years prior to his 7 years of, well, mental wandering, if you will. For 43 years, he reigned supreme over his kingdom. It was in the last 7 years of his life that he went insane, and God granted him a clear mind after that 7 years. We read about it in Nebuchadnezzar's own hand. He wrote in the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel, in Aramaic, by the way. So in making Nebuchadnezzar's presentation or his experience, Daniel was reminding Belshazzar of what he should have known. That God is superior to you, Belshazzar. He was superior to your grandfather and your father and everybody else before them. And you must know that if you have anything going on at all good with you, it is a result of what God has done. And you must acknowledge him, for he will not hold you guiltless to do so. Verse 21 completes the description of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. That's hard to understand today, because in a democracy we vote for who we want. And sometimes a person is voted into office who we don't like, and we get mad, as if God has nothing to say about it. Does God allow people in office whom he chooses? Whom he permits? That's a question to be answered by those who say and wear bumper stickers that say, he's not my president. Just an aside to consider. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, in the wildness of his mind, there is historical record in the various writers of the Greek philosophers and so forth, people who have referred back to that historical time and said some strange illness came over Nebuchadnezzar. It's in historical records. You can find it in the Nebuchadnezzar Chronicles and places like that. It was a strange sickness that came over him. Well, for 7 years he was out munching grass like a cow. Because of his arrogance. Because he assumed that he was all and all that it was ever to be. Verse 22 says, yet you, his descendant, his son, his grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart even though you knew all this. We shake our heads at situations like this, like we shake our heads about the ancient Israelites. How in the world could those people have turned against God so quickly out of Egypt? And to moan and whine and grind their teeth about, you know, we should have stayed in Egypt and, been by the flesh pots and having those leeks and onions and all that kind of stuff. And you brought us out here to die. And we say, how could they? And we read about Belshazzar. Belshazzar, your grandfather was confronted by the Most High God. How can you still talk about the gods? And how could you be so disrespectful to the implements taken from the house of God? And yet, we all do it every day. We disrespect God. We carry His name, which leads into one of the other commandments, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. We think of that as some profane thing. That's something that we say. And it's not anything we do. But the lesson that leaps out of these pages is that God will not tolerate any of that. And Belshazzar, Daniel tells him, you should have known. But you have, in verse 23, exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and that you have brought the vessels of his house before you. You and your nobles, your wives, your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand, but the God in whose hands are your life breath and your ways you have not glorified. The challenge in reading the book of Daniel and not get hung up on the prophetic notions is, how do you apply what Daniel observes? How do you apply and relate to Belshazzar? How do you relate to Daniel? What would you do in the like circumstance? How can you assess where you stand before the Most High God? If you can successfully navigate through those waters, the handwriting of the wall is not for you. But if you have had difficulty, let's understand the inscription. Here's what Daniel says in verse 24. Then the hand was sent from him. The question is, whose hand was it? Well, it may have been God's hand. It could have been an angel's hand. It doesn't matter whose hand. What was the message? When we understand that the message is more important than the messenger, and I know the philosophical notion, well, if the message is one thing and then the messenger is tainted, well, Jonah was tainted. He hated the Babylonians. He hated the Ninevites. We understand that, don't we? He was motivated by hate. He was motivated by the fact that if these people don't repent, then God's going to wipe them off the face of the earth, and me as a Hebrew, well, I can rejoice in that. But God spared Nineveh. And Jonah was ticked off because his heart was not right. So God revealed something about Jonah to Jonah that Jonah couldn't handle. All right, so we mustn't dismiss the message getting hung up on the messenger. Now, verse 25. Here's the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Interesting expressions, to be sure. A little play on words in the last word here, but the interpretation of the message is following, so we don't have to speculate about it. We don't have to wonder about it at all. This, Daniel says in verse 26, is the inscription, the interpretation of the message, rather. Mene means numbered, but it's mentioned twice, which is an emphasis to say you are thoroughly numbered. You know, when you say verily, verily, when Christ would say that, or truly, truly, it was a double emphasis. Have you ever double emphasize something? I want you to listen to what I'm saying. Have you ever done that? So you know that's a double emphasis with your children. I see parents saying, yeah, boy, did you hear what I said? Because you're emphasizing it. You want it to get through. So, you are numbered thoroughly. Mene, mene. Your kingdom has been put to an end. Tekel, verse 27, you have been weighed, that's what it means, weighed on the scale and found deficient, wanting. And Perez, which is a play on the word Persian. That's an interesting little note. When you examine what it means, your kingdom has been divided. Perez means divided, but it's also a play on the word for Parisian, or Persian, I should say. Persian. Because your kingdom is going to be given over, in verse 28, to the Medes and the Persians. Well, I have to tell you, and I'm sure you can imagine, as verse 29 comes to us, we see Belshazzar being told, you are numbered thoroughly. You've been weighed, assessed, and analyzed, and critiqued, and you don't measure up. And in fact, you will find your demise. Your kingdom will be destroyed, taken over by, and the specific people are named. This is what causes the many authorities who look at this trouble. I mean, how could Daniel have named the people who was going to do it? On top of it, it happened that night. It's not a lot of preparing time, is it? Not a lot of time for repenting, I guess. Verse 29 says, then Belshazzar gave orders. Another problem people have is that Belshazzar went ahead and fulfilled his word to what he promised Daniel to get. He gave him a purple robe and a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler of the kingdom. That's a lot to do when you've just been told the jig is up. But maybe it was kind of an effort on Belshazzar's part to get it right. Maybe. But it didn't change the course of what God was going to do. Verse 30. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. When is it time to do right? Deathbed confession? Or should we take the time now and not wait until it's too late to make and effect a change? Verse 31 says, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, there are some interesting little things to consider. When we talk about the issue of who wrote, whose hand was it that wrote, and so forth and so on, what we should extract from this chapter is, when God sets his hand to a matter, it is set. When God puts his hand to do a thing, you cannot turn it back. And another aspect to consider as we go through this particular book and have looked at this chapter, God chose a messenger in that he selected Daniel, and his name appropriately signifies a characteristic of God, that he is the one who judges. He judged Daniel, he judged the Hebrew boys, he judged the kings of Babylon, and he judges even to this day. God is judge. When we consider some of the names that appear in this book, like Belshazzar, God protect the king. Well, he meant Bel, protect the king. He didn't mean the great God. If Belshazzar could have come to that, as his grandfather had come to see it, then maybe God would have spared him. Yahweh would have spared him. Now, the name Belteshazzar, as we have learned, means Bel protect his life. Well, Daniel did not need the protection of Bel, for he was under the protection of God Almighty. That's who was on Daniel's side. So as we consider the coming of the judge, and whether or not the handwriting is on the wall in your life or my life, let's conclude that we will rally under the protection, under the banner of the God who matters. For it's that same God that Daniel worshiped that we access, that we can embrace, and who embraces us, so that we ultimately will never find written on our walls, We've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. It's our choice. For God who judges, judges in secret and in public. So next time we will take a look at Daniel's journey to the lion's den. For even Daniel, in his triumph, was challenged, as are we.